Hello and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone.
How's it going? I know we're recording a little bit later than we normally do, but nonetheless, still plenty of time before football.
Yeah, it's, to be honest, I'm a bundle of nerves because we are about just under 5 hours away from NLDS Game 5, so that will be the death of me, probably, based on how the series has gone. But otherwise, I feel I'm all right.
This is the importance of hedging, Dan. I get to sit back and just enjoy the game and really not be overly distraught about the outcome. And that's weird for me in sports because I usually find a reason to get invested in any game in any sport.
I mean, not all of us can be so baseball polygamous, John.
That's fair. I am a baseball Mormon. What can I say? Waiting for someone in the comments to... Most Mormons don't have polygamy anymore. It's fun. Without getting too far down that rabbit hole.
We are aware that the Mormon faith is more modern than what we just said.
Yeah, very much so. I know many Mormons out here, and none of them are polygamous. Moving on. So Syracuse is facing Virginia on Saturday. And, Virginia's 1-4. I think their fans are kind of checked out of the Mike London era at this point.
As in, like, 2013?
Yeah, just like 2013.
This point is in the last 2.5 years.
But it seems that the buyout is finally at a point where UVA might actually be on board with it, which I think is a good thing for them. We don't face them enough for it really to be a bad thing for us. But Dan, what do you think about the 1-4 Hoos? Are they actually bad? Do we want to look at the Pitt game as more, kind of emblematic of what they may be? Or are you too focused in on what happened to them against a team like Boise State?
I think actually bad is probably fair. I don't think they're good. That being said, they have played almost every team pretty tough, with the exception of Boise State, who just that game was awful. Like I think I was up in Syracuse when that game was happening, watching it from the bar, and it was just one of those games where you look up every like 3 minutes and Boise has more points. But other than that, I mean they lost 34-16 to a pretty decent UCLA team. They should have beaten Notre Dame, as we saw. They beat William & Mary narrowly, which isn't great, and then they lost to Pitt by a touchdown. So aside from Boise, they've been pretty competitive. Eventually, as we talk about with Syracuse's own issues in big games, being pretty competitive is nice, but it's been, 5 years for Mike London, and he's made one bowl, and that was pretty much coming on the tail of the last coach. So it's not like, eventually it has to turn into wins, and hasn't done that yet. I think they're rightfully considered probably one of the two worst teams in the ACC. That doesn't mean that we're going to go down there and automatically beat them, because I will still say that USF was the worst team left on our schedule last weekend, and they beat us by 20-something. So it'll still be a pretty tough game. I don't think we're, so much better than Virginia that it won't be. But I wouldn't consider them a good team by any stretch.
That's very fair. So I know last week you and I had both said that, it was awesome to see Syracuse head down to a more manageable opponent like USF down in Tampa as the first road game for a lot of these kids on our offense, on our defense, just, a lot of freshmen and a lot of redshirt freshmen and redshirt sophomores, all who were big contributors but hadn't really traveled before. Do you still feel the same way? Do you think that last week, maybe not just the fact that they were on the road, but the fact that they got shellacked on the road by an inferior team, do you think that that pays dividends this week?
I have no idea. I don't know. We don't really know how being on the road impacted last week versus, I know we heard about the heat and whatnot, but that... it's kind of a hollow excuse, I think, considering we play in a dome that it's like 90 degrees anytime in September. So It's hard to tell how much being on the road impacted them, or if they just kind of laid an egg and it would have happened at the Dome too. So I think, you know, I'm sure they'll be a little more used to the experience of going on the plane and staying in the hotel and everything. You know, maybe that kind of shakes the cobwebs off for even the guys who have done it in years past. But I don't know that taking a 24 point loss, or what was it, 21 point? Was it 45-24?
Yeah,
the final of the USFGM. Yeah, 21-point loss on the road is ever going to be a great thing against a, you know, one win AAC team. So hopefully that is it. Hopefully they just weren't used to it and now they're okay. But I don't know that I'd bet on that being the case.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that loss, while it doesn't necessarily ring very hopeful for us now. I mean, we don't really know what South Florida turns into. I saw them as a team that can really hang around kind of the 5-6 win mark. So, I mean, no, that's not something to really brag about. But, you know, I'd much rather that versus them trending down the other way and that loss for us looking even worse. You can't really get, you know, a lot of good out of a loss even a week later. I think especially a week later. But, you know, if anything, hopefully, you know, these players do understand how to play on the road. Hopefully that that excuse is done and tired and out the window. I mean, everyone, you know, on Slack and even in the Noons comment section, everyone was kind of confused about that, and on Twitter too, about how the temperature down in, you know, Central Florida area really had any sort of bearing on this game, and especially when, you know, you can sort of simulate these things. You can turn up the heat in buildings. You can do a lot to prepare for weather. And it's not like it's the first time most of these players have been to Florida. It's not like it's the first time that the program has faced USF down in Florida. Like, there's a lot of things that just shoot that empty excuse in the face. And as Brent Dax pointed out on Twitter when he and I were talking about it, you know, on the 31st, we head down to Tallahassee, where it's arguably going to be even, you know, more balmy. Yes, a couple weeks later, but I would say Tallahassee's, you know, I'd say landlocked a little bit more. It gets more into that deep south part of, you know, Alabama in the Panhandle versus, you know, at least in Tampa. I feel like there is a little bit of some fresh air, but I know that's minimal at best given the Florida effect.
Yeah, and heat's just one of those things that it's a fact of life when you're playing football in a conference that has multiple Florida teams, a bunch of Southern teams. Like, it's not an excuse that anyone's going to want to hear. Like, you're not making anyone feel better. So, it just, you know, I could have done without hearing about the heat being an issue, especially because it didn't seem like we had all that many cramping issues, even compared to some games at the Dome.
Yeah, that's very, very, very true, and I think, you know, you didn't see those cramping issues too until later on in the game when it was already out of hand. So you can't tell me that the cramping and exhaustion from heat. I mean, the players didn't look like they were exhausted. They looked like they were just ill prepared. So I guess, Dan, to you, how much of the game and the loss in particular was a lack of preparation, and how much of it was just a lack of execution?
I think those are the major, or at least watching the game from afar, those were the major things that impacted it. I mean, USF has some talent. They do get the occasional, you know, really solid Florida player. I think Marlon Mack's legit, but they're not better than LSU for sure. They're probably not that much better than Central Michigan. But it does seem like Willie Taggart put together a really good game plan, saw some things he could exploit with misdirection, with some different counter plays, and they just threw every possible misdirection look at us, and their ground game just absolutely gashed Syracuse's defense in a way we really haven't seen very often. I mean, if you're going to beat us with straight talent, that's whatever. I can't get mad about that. But the only other time I can remember the Bulla defense really looked that confused and unable to react to a play was when Georgia Tech ran their triple option all over us. And South Florida definitely ran an offense that we don't see a ton of with all of that misdirection, which was like the total staple of the running game for them. And I'm not sure if that's been it the whole year or if they just identified that Syracuse wasn't good in those situations, but it was ugly. So generally the defensive coaching staff has been able to adjust to things like that outside of that Georgia Tech game. They just weren't for South Florida, so hopefully it's just a blip. But it was not encouraging, and it did kind of pretty much all the fears that we had going into the game. Between maybe we didn't point out, you know, counters so much, but even the screen passing game was huge for them, and we talked about that a lot. So it wasn't it basically justified the minimal fears we had heading into the game, and it makes me worried for pretty much everyone going forward, because I think pretty much every team on the schedule can find a way to dump balls out to the running back in the flat. What's going to happen with Dalvin Cook gets in the open field? Like, it's going to be really, really ugly.
Yeah, that's the scary part here. And I know, like, in some ways you want to say, well, you know, this is the anomaly still on the schedule. But at the same time, I mean, there's been things that have been true since the Wake Forest game, because I think the Rhode Island game, you can throw out those results, you can throw out those statistics. Looking solely at from Wake Forest to now, there are some really, really big issues with this defense, and anyone telling themselves otherwise, you know, is just straight up lying to themselves, to others, to whomever. You look at a team that struggles to cover passes in the flat, that struggles to cover downfield, because you're looking at 10-yard cushions and corners on an island. Excuse me. You're looking at a team that, while we keep talking about how great they are against the run, a Wake Forest team that can't run was gashing them between the tackles. A Central Michigan team that, honestly, we should have a huge size advantage on in the trenches was gashing them. An LSU team that, yes, was supposed to, but, you know, something I hinted on at in that game was just they were getting manhandled and it looked bad. And, you know, yes, it's Fournette, so I'm not going to really come down on them too much, but Fournette did still, you know, record his career high in yardage in that game, and would have had, you know, another, what, 80-plus yards, if not for that other run that got called back. And then USF, I mean, USF, they ran the ball primarily, but not the way they did. I mean, it's all because everybody on, you know, the Syracuse team is way too quick to bite when they do blitz, and it seems like they're reducing blitzing a little bit, oddly. But when they do blitz, they're over-pursuing. Nobody's wrapping up. And while this game might have been just a case of just straight up getting beat a lot of the time, I mean, the lack of wrapping up has become, you know, kind of a calling card of this defense. And what I kind of want to know now is, you know, where are the answers? Because with this group, it's not like there's really a ton of injuries right now. It's not like there wasn't enough time to prepare for this game. We had 2 weeks. I'm getting concerned that this is just going to keep happening, and the teams, I mean, if me, someone who covers the team, but, you know, isn't spending hours in a film room or hours coaching kids, can identify the short passing game as a key to the entire, you know, USF offense, and our own coaches can't or won't or can't get the results on the field to stop it, then I'm definitely trending more negatively on the outlook for the rest of the year.
Yeah, and hopefully this is all just one bad performance and they bounce back. But looking at the numbers for Virginia, their leading receiver, as you know, we probably don't want to see, is their running back, Taquan Mizell, who has 35 targets. Well, he's not the leading receiver. He's one catch behind Kanan Severin, who's very good. But he has 3 touchdown catches. He averages over 13.5. He averages 13.5 yards a catch, almost 10 yards a target, and he's their leader in targets. So they throw to the flat a lot. That's worrisome if the staff can't shore that up. And then obviously UVA has Severin, who's a very legitimate good receiver. So their passing game isn't great, but it does do the things that DU Syracuse fits last week. And unfortunately, if we're going to continue leaving our cornerbacks on islands and not doing anything to prevent that short passing game from just eating up chunks of yardage, it doesn't matter if teams don't go deep on us. So, it's definitely a concern, but maybe it was just one bad week of preparation. Obviously, the weeks before that, there were other issues. Overall, it's hard to know. This team still continues to be pretty unpredictable from week to week. where, you know, in years past, we kind of knew what we were at this point without barring injuries. We're pretty healthy now, and I still don't have a good read on what Syracuse looks like. I will have a very good read on what they look like if they lose this game, which is not good. So hopefully we can avoid that and continue the mystery going forward.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, before the season I said that it wasn't this game, it wasn't the USF game, it was the Pitt game that really kind of defined what the season is. And obviously, you know, we had hopes that we'd be 5-1 going into that Pitt game. It seems like, I mean, 4-2, we're looking at 4-2 seems much, much, much more probable now versus, you know, 3-3. But I think that could also be, you know, a little bit of us getting our hopes up, et cetera. I think in general, that Pitt game, again, is going to really decide, you know, what are you, what can you do well, what can't you do well, are you going to make a bowl? Because the season's going to come down to, at this point, what happens against Pitt, UVA, NC State, and Boston College. So that's the next two games and then the last two games. And in between, I mean, you don't want to chalk up games to a loss, but I'm pretty certain, I think you're pretty certain too, that we're not going to have a great showing against Clemson and Florida State. Louisville's still debatable, but for right now, I'll keep them in the bucket that we had them in going into this season.
Yeah, after I lose to South Florida by 21, I'm not exactly predicting a win in Tallahassee. That is correct. or a win in Syracuse against the number one ranked S&P team.
Also fair. I know you mentioned Severin, and I think that he is probably the X factor for this defense, offense, given the fact that Syracuse defense is, well, not great against the pass, especially, you know, I think teams have been taking, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but, you know, taking 3 to 5 shots downfield and connecting on all of them. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, flea flicker, reverse. It just seems that, you know, play action, it doesn't matter. You could just do a quick 3-step drop and you'll probably beat us, you know, 40 yards deep. And I think that Severin is the type of athlete, and I was paying attention to him last week, and I was paying attention to him in the Notre Dame game as well. And he is a guy who can find himself open, who can get downfield very quickly. And I'm not really impressed by Matt Johns, but at the same time, you know, we've made lesser quarterbacks look better. And that, to me, is the really, really scary factor of, you know, what happens if this team starts, like any other, really, the face of the series, what happens if this team starts connecting on deep balls? I think we're dead to rights, because it's not that I think that Eric Dungy can't bring the team back. It's that I don't think it's fair to force him to bring us back, because I feel like it cuts the play calling in half. It really handcuffs what he can do. It fails to utilize a lot of our running backs, in particular Jordan Fredericks. I mean, you saw the numbers and the play calling breakdown just like everybody else. I mean, we just decided we were just passing the ball. There was no run. There was no question of misdirection after a while. There was no question of play action. It was just Dungy's going to throw. They could blitz, you know, 4 to 5 guys and see what happened. And for a while, it was working for us. And then after, you know, some time, you can't expect Dungy to just continually connect and continually, you know, get the ball in the end zone when the offensive line was fading very quickly in the second half. And, you know, with drives for USF getting faster and faster, there was much less time for Syracuse's skill players to, you know, get a few minutes of rest, some water, and then get back out there at 100%.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember he's a freshman, and he's, you know, there are so many things he hasn't seen in games yet. He's only played a couple of teams, different looks, whatnot. And I thought he actually, you know, he didn't have a great game by far, you know, was not his best game by any means. But I actually thought his performance was pretty decent for, like, a bad game from a freshman. Like, his, you know, 232 yards, 2 touchdowns, only 1 pick, his first pick of the year, completed, you know, roughly 2/3 of his passes. I mean, if that's a bad game from Eric Dungy, I think that's pretty, you know, it makes me feel better. I do think he's been very quick trigger to pull the ball and run. And the options, like, I like them situationally. I don't like them being the staple of the run game, but there is no way Eric Dungy should be getting 17 carries. It's not healthy. He's not like there physically yet. I'm fine with him scrambling on occasion and taking off what he can pick up a big chunk of yardage, and I like the option every so often when it's going to catch a defense off guard. But I mean, we saw it in USF. Like, they were, I mean, they gave him a couple big plays on it, but they were generally ready for it. It wasn't a surprise. They knew it was coming. So hopefully we can start getting the, you know, traditional run game a little bit more of a look. Jordan Frederick's had some moments. Obviously, his biggest one was on that dump off pass, but I think I'm glad to see he's atop the depth chart. But we really need to get our running backs more than five, 4 or 5 carries in a game. Obviously, we were playing from behind, but I do think we need to find the right equation there, because what we did in South Florida didn't work.
Right. And you know, I think this is where when I do the weekly play calling breakdown, something that provides a little bit of value is the fact that I'm not counting pocket breakdown scrambles as runs. I'm counting them as passes because they were called pass plays. With Dungy, that can be a little bit of a gray area, just because there are so many play fakes, and he'll literally play action into a bootleg or play action into an option look. But what you saw in that game were, you know, twice as many passing plays called as run plays. That was the second straight week we'd seen that. And it was a concern for a lot of folks heading into the season of, well, you know, Lester's a former QB coach, he's a former QB. This seems like a recipe for us going more and more toward the pass. And maybe it is. I think if that is the case, what he's missing out on is the fact that we throw the ball best when we're running effectively. He seemed to harp on that a little bit in comments to the media. He was saying that Dungy took off a couple too many times. I don't think that's really the blame shouldn't necessarily be put on the freshman quarterback. I think it might want to be on the veteran offensive line that couldn't really, you know, help him out for much of that game. I know that there was definitely some consternation around. I know I made comments about it. I think Sean did too. Like, that the guy has to scramble too much, but Dungy and Lester also have a little too much confidence in what Dungy can do with those option looks. I mean, that you and I said the same thing, and everybody else did too. That one play on the sideline where, you know, he's got to learn how to tuck the ball. He's got to learn how to, you know, get on the ground, because you take a couple hits like that and your career's over, kid. Like, I don't know what else to say. Like, you would think, and I like the fearlessness, especially coming back from a concussion, but if he gets another hit or two like that, he's going to have another concussion, and then we're going to be, you know, SOL at the quarterback position again. So I really do hope that, you know, whether it's by play design, which should be, and or by, you know, his own decision making, that this becomes a much less reckless kind of, you know, fly by the seat of your pants offense, and more of a concerted attack. It doesn't need to be basic handoffs either. We can run some counters. We have delayed handoffs. Frederick's obviously knows how to tear it up both on the edge and between the tackles. Like, utilize him, get him carries. Find a way to, I mean, the fact that McFarland was really not at all on the field, and it wasn't due to health or anything. It was just because they didn't use him. Like, to me, you know, that's inexplicable, and it's something that's got to be addressed against Virginia, or else we're in for a very rough second half of the season.
Yeah, and it's not to, you know, harp on Dungy too much, because he is a freshman, and one of the things with freshman quarterbacks that you do see is that they don't quite have that internal clock perfect. So I'm not shocked that he was pulling the ball as much as he did. I just think that needs to be a point of, you know, a learning point going forward. But I think the concussion thing is a good point, because I've been thinking this week with the AJ Long news, and I totally support Syracuse in their concussion policy. I think it's a good one. I'm fine being conservative with it, because it's, you know, all the stuff coming out about CTE and even subconcussive hits is really terrifying. But we do want to be careful with our players, you know, for their own health. And Dungy, we don't know 100% that he's in concussion, but I think we're all pretty confident that's what he had, that's what he was out with. So he's, you know, two strikes away, and I would hope that the team wouldn't go against its own, you know, ethical standards to protect a starting quarterback. So I think everyone involved just needs to be kind of aware of the situation and make sure he's in the best position to succeed both as a quarterback and physically. Because obviously he's only been on campus for a couple months. So hopefully get a little less concussion prone as he, gets in, does all the various weight training, which I don't know how much is proven, but there are some things with like neck muscles and stuff that people think will help concussion prevention. But overall, we just, we don't want to lose players because of either a reckless style of play or play calling that is putting them in bad situations. And I'm not saying that was necessarily the case, but it is something to be cognizant of, especially with the long news coming out this week.
Oh, of course. And yeah, like you said, you don't want to point a finger at Dungy or Lester on their own here. It's just more of a, hey guys, why don't we just think these things through a little bit before we're, my heart was in my throat, and I'm sure you felt the same way during that one hit where, the guy helicoptered, and I thought for a second he went basically ragdoll. Like, that's not, I don't care if you're a fifth-year senior, that's not what you want to see. And, it's another case of, and I think Dungy's going to see this a lot. I don't think it's right, but when Dungy gets firing on all cylinders, he's pretty tough to stop. And I think we saw this against CMU, and I think that's part of what led to the frustration on CMU's side that ultimately, kind of brought about that adrenaline rush and the dirty hit on him. But you could see the frustration, on the faces of those players during that drive where the injury happened. And for USF, I think once they got rolling, yes, they were up, but I don't necessarily think they took kindly to a freshman really kind of being able to just carve through that defense, whether it was on the ground or through the air. And it's just something to keep in mind that, don't make yourself a target unnecessarily. Obviously, he's going to take off. Obviously, his legs are part of his selling point, but there is a caveat there. And we have skilled players. We have players who can block for you. Don't put yourself in harm's way if you don't need to.
Yeah, for sure. And hopefully this weekend, we'll have the exact opposite game and we go and surprise and win by 20, and then we just have no idea what this team is. And hopefully there's no injuries. And then I think, I don't know how much whiplash the fan base will have, but I guess it'd be better than the alternative of losing this game and then things seem incredibly dire.
Yes, please. Right, and on that note, a little halftime. What have you been drinking, Dan? I know it's been a trying week as baseball is baseballing all over the place.
Yeah. I'm just glad I'm not as tough as it's been for the Mets, I don't know how I would have reacted if I was a Blue Jays fan yesterday after that seventh inning. But nothing too crazy this week. I tried I've had it before, but Sierra Nevada's Oktoberfest, which is just available this year. Quite good. Definitely a different thing for them to try out, but unsurprisingly, they did it pretty well. And then Magic Hat, which I'm a fan of generally, has their Wilhelm Scream pumpkin beer, which wasn't as big on. I think it was like almost a little too sweet, too much with the hitting you over the head with the flavor, which I'm not as big a fan of. I like it to be more of a beer that tastes like, with some pumpkin flavors rather than a pumpkin drink that happens to be alcoholic. So, and then just a lot of other like standard stuff that we talk about a decent amount, 312 Urban Wheat, etc. So, no need to really go too far into those, but it's been a kind of a normal week. Just lots of probably more drinking than usual during the week with all these baseball games, which have been quite stressful.
Fair enough. For me, had Modern Times, their first double IPA. It's a Lost Horizon. Really, really good beer. Was having that during the Mets Dodgers game last Friday. Was it Friday? Yes, it was Friday. Deschutes has their annual kind of Black Butte anniversary ale. This was the 27th edition. It was like a really interesting Imperial Stout. I want to say. Maybe it was a porter. Could have been a porter. But, yeah. It was aged in bourbon barrels. They had some cocoa nibs. There was a, seemed like a little bit of apricot. Overall, really enjoyable beer. I don't know how much Deschutes gets around on the East Coast, but I'd highly recommend it if you can find it. Had Modern Times Floating World over at a beer shop over by me. Very, very good IPA from them. And Mega Blazing World. Blazing World is their very good hoppy amber. And Mega Blazing World is the double version of that. And also went over to Phantom Carriage over in Carson, California, not too far from here. Just kind of popped over on, I think it was Saturday night. They kind of have a 50s horror theme as their whole shtick. And a lot of great sours. The one I really liked was the Lagosi. It was a dark sour. Really enjoyable stuff. Kind of saved that one for last, which I liked a lot. And then last night had a Noble Ale Works Galaxy Showers. Talk about Noble a bunch. They're down in Anaheim, like right across the street from the pond and the Angel Stadium. And they have their Shower Series, which is a double IPA series that features one kind of hop strain, this time Galaxy. Again, just very, very good. So yeah, that's my whole beer repertoire for the past week.
Yeah, I'm gonna assume that. Well, I don't know about you. I know you're staying neutral and going to be happy with whoever advances tonight. But I'm going to take a guess and say there might be some beer consumed in my Manhattan apartment tonight.
One way or the other.
Yeah, it's gonna happen. I don't know. It's been. I don't know. I'm very nervous. I don't like facing Zach Greinke in elimination games. I have all the faith in Jacob deGrom in the world, but I don't know. We'll see. That last game killed me. So if they win, then I feel a little better in a 7-game series than a 5. And against the Cubs, who have one pitcher who's really worth his salt. But we'll get to that if we get to that.
It's fair. I know for me, if I had a rooting interest in any of these games, it was in Game 4. Just because I felt that, Kershaw's gotten kind of a bad rap as a playoff pitcher. And for anyone who's been paying attention, and it's odd because you would think people that are paid to write about baseball would pay attention. He really hasn't pitched poorly. He's had a lot of great starts that have had either a bad seventh inning or, he's had some terrible relief help or no run support. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't have it in front of me, but I doubt his playoff ERA is really above 3.
He had the two really bad starts, which I think were back-to-back, and that kind of sours everyone.
They were back-to-back, the ones last year.
Yeah.
But that said, I'm pretty sure he gave up 4-1 and 3 in the other. Now, in the playoffs, that's a different story. Like, obviously, like if you gave up 4 runs and 3 runs the next game during the regular season, I don't think anyone's sitting there going, oh, what a terrible pitcher. But it just so happened that both games were kind of mirror images of one another. Both games saw him go into the 7th and, was pitching well, and suddenly the wheels came off. Wasn't great because he's not the type of pitcher in the regular season at all. I mean, I was at that 115 strikeout game this past season where, he basically shouted Donnie down and told him to get back in the dugout while just, plowing through Giants batters. I wanted him to just get the win just so we could move on from that narrative. And I know it's not completely dead, and obviously if the Dodgers lose tonight, it'll be very much alive. Just because of the fact that, Kershaw is still 2-6 in playoff starts. There's not a lot of things to hang your hat on besides, he's got a high strikeout count and he doesn't have a horrendous ERA. So we'll see. Like I said, I'm neutral. I win kind of no matter what. That's a terrible thing to do in sports, and it's not something I endorse in any other sport. I have extenuating circumstances in baseball, and I will leave my excuses at that.
Yep. Well, I will be happy to welcome you fully aboard the Mets bandwagon should we somehow outlast the Dodgers in this coming game. I am very unconfident that that will happen, but we'll see. We do have Harvey and Syndergaard available tonight, so if DeGrom falters, we are just going to go all out with all of our incredible depth of pitching and hope that can kind of stymie what Greinke's going to do to us, which I'm sure he'll give up like three hits and maybe we'll get lucky and scratch a header on. But more than that, I really don't know. Hopefully, if we can get into the bullpen in any kind, like if we get into the bullpen by the seventh inning, like that's pretty much all I can hope for, runs, you know, aside from any runs. And if it's close and both starters are out, then I'll feel pretty good. But otherwise, it's going to be a nail biter.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, there's nothing really about this series that has made sense, start to finish, which is weird because I feel like even at the end of the day, if something unexpected happens, it's because of that one thing you thought, okay, like if that occurs, then we're going to see this result. And I don't think it's likely, but it could happen. In this one, I feel like every game's been weird. Every game has existed both in a bubble and as a greater sum of five parts. I think that, you know, game three was just an absolutely insane show of force by the Mets and was obviously powered by what happened in game two. I think game four for the Dodgers was by and large, you know, willed into existence by Kershaw and the fact that, you know, batters just have not supported him. It's been a crazy weird series. I think the playoffs have been crazy weird, and I think the fact that the Cardinals are out now is obviously a victory for all of us. And on top of that, it makes things incredibly interesting because you have a lot. I mean, at this point, the Royals are the most experienced team left, and other than the Cardinals to start, they already were the most experienced team in the playoffs, really. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I know I was mentioned to a friend of mine. It's weird. For the NL teams, all four of them, I have been to every ballpark this year. So my new thing is, if somebody wants to make the World Series on the NL side, have me at your ballpark, because chances are your team is at least going to make the playoffs.
That's clearly the what happened here.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, I even briefly was next to the Cardinals ballpark and was hanging out in the concourse. So I feel like it was just me. It wasn't the drafting. It wasn't the matchups. It was really just my presence.
Yes, which doesn't explain anything to do with Syracuse football.
Actually, I have a whole nother theory about Syracuse football. Syracuse football has not lost a game I've attended since early November of 2009.
Well then.
So, again, moral of the story is somebody pay for me to go to Syracuse football games.
Moral of the story is to go play Wake Forest more often.
Also true. Although this year I'll be at NC State, which could be a harbinger of good things.
I would enjoy beating them.
It's funny. I know we talk about this occasionally on the site. Like, there's, outside of Clemson, like, I feel like I just hate NC State. And I don't know why. Like, I mean, I know a little bit why. Because they got really lucky last year against, like, our third string team, basically. And then, you know, Gottfried's comments about us before we even got there, I felt were just stupid. But, yeah, in general, like, I don't like perennial dark horses that never deliver. And, like, goes for them. Goes for North Carolina a little bit, but we don't face them as much. There's just a certain amount of, like, I just get sick and tired of hearing about untapped potential.
Yeah, and they were kind of, like, dickish when we joined the conference, which was never... They pretty much kind of decided how we chose to like or dislike teams going forward, I think. Clemson obviously came in hot, but NC State with the Dodd-Fried stuff, what didn't help. And obviously they didn't like us because we took over their basketball arena the year before, which they clearly didn't realize was a thing that we do. But now they know.
See, yeah, I wouldn't blame people for not knowing that. Especially, I feel like the ACC, more than any other conference, really does exist in like this insular kind of like land apart from everything, while also being at the center of everything at the same time. for college basketball. Like, the Pac-12 hangs out on the West, like, literally doesn't pay attention to anything else that goes on, but also no one's paying attention to it. And that sucks, because I feel like that was the way it was for Pac-12 football for a long time, until, you know, Scott showed up and really kind of changed the way that league seemed. But where he hasn't done it is basketball. I think basketball still kind of exists in this weird kind of West Coast bubble. But the ACC, they've always kind of existed. And I saw that, I felt this way when we were in the Big East, too. I felt that, you know, the ACC had kind of become this, you know, insular group out there. They did their thing. They were usually one of the big storylines of the season, but they really couldn't care less for the things that happened outside of the conference. And I feel that that is once again the case here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's, especially with basketball, I mean, the ACC is kind of, it's the only major conference that cares about basketball as a whole more than football. So it's always going to be a bit of an outsider in that way. And there was, you know, a bit of that Carolina superiority complex, which I think generally thumbed its nose at the Big East. So even when the Big East was a better league for years. So, yeah, that's... I think that's partially true, and it is definitely true about the Pac-12. Even in football, I think there's just a difference in attitude out in the Pac-12. I always get the feeling that, you know, we're in the SEC, football is like the number one thing. In the Pac-12, they'll fill out the for the most part, they'll fill the stadiums, and Saturdays are big, but like the rest of the week, I feel like football isn't the, you know, the whole week isn't dedicated towards the build-up to Saturday, where it is in the SEC and parts of the Big 12 and the Big 10 and whatnot. So I think it's definitely like a different feel overall in that conference. And then basketball is just kind of like an unknown thing outside of like Arizona when they're good, or UCLA on occasion, because they do have some, they have been a pretty decent league for the last couple of years after that one year where they were pretty terrible. I enjoy watching their games. You get Bill Walton, which is always nice.
Yeah, you bring up a good point there. I mean, as someone who is in the clearly in the footprint for the Pac-12 and arguably in the kind of center of the league, given both its, you know, actual geographic center as well as the two biggest brands it has to offer, USC and UCLA, from an all-sports standpoint, I think, you know, you're right. The build-up to these games just isn't, like, I'll talk about on Monday if I'm going to an SC or UCLA game, I'll talk about it, and, like, everyone's like, oh, they're playing this weekend, who are they playing? Like, and I just feel like you would never see that down south. I know for me, I brought up the basketball thing in particular because you literally do not hear about Pac-12 basketball here, like, at all. The only time I hear anything about Pac-12 basketball is when I'm listening to the radio on the way into work, because I usually just try to get, I mean, I check Twitter in the morning, but then I try to at least get like a broad strokes view of what's going on in sports on the way in. So like Dan Patrick happens to be on, I'll get a quick kind of download on what the big stories are. But what I find interesting is that the only time I hear about even UCLA basketball is like when they have promos on that station. And it's odd to me. I think that, you know, I mean, this is just such a Lakers town when it comes to basketball that like, UCLA's recent, you know, kind of, mediocrity for them. Overall, their lack of titles in the last 20 years or so. And obviously the Lakers have done a hell of a lot. I mean, even now, like, you're still seeing more conversations about the Lakers than the Clippers. And Dan, I'm sure, is a Nets fan in New York. You can relate to that sort of, you know, one team is doing better than the other, but they're still talking about the other one. type narrative when it comes to the Knicks and Nets.
Yeah. I can't really blame them in the Nets thing, because while the Nets have definitely been the better, I mean, they've been the better franchise for over a decade now, pretty consistently, aside from like the really awful like couple years before Billy King took back over. The Knicks are hilarious, at least, and they're obviously they're in Manhattan, they're at the Garden, so they have that built-in kitsch there. But they're hilarious. Like, it's a hilarious franchise in terms of just everything they do wrong. The Nets are just generally kind of boring, and I acknowledge this as a Nets fan, both in like playing style, even like the controversies are not that exciting. compared to the Knicks, so I get it, but it is a little lame. Like, even like the complaints about the Nets fans, you know, what do you expect? It's basically a rebooted franchise in a place that hasn't had pro sports in forever. I've been to a dozen Nets games. You know, it's not sold out, but it's not like there's not, it's not half full. Like, they get people in there, so it's, you know, it's kind of a fact of life for the Nets right now. Hopefully it changes a bit as they become kind of an established part of the, you know, Brooklyn scene and everything, but that's definitely true. So, and I think most of us just kind of learn to live with it.
That's fair. I mean, I guess to an extent, people deal with that out here when it comes to USC football versus UCLA football and UCLA basketball versus USC basketball. I know there's a bit of it with any Angels fans I know in LA County. As much as the Angels try, they are not an LA team. They play in Anaheim. Stop saying you're from LA. You're not. I know one of my favorite Dodgers shirts that I don't own, but I know a lot of people who own it. This is from a couple of years ago. It was just a big in big bold letters on the front. It says Los Angeles Dodgers of Los Angeles, and I've always appreciated the sentiment there.
The Angels thing is still so ridiculous every time I hear it. They're the Anaheim Angels. I don't care. I get the LA Angel thing has kind of just worked, and it is what it is now. But that when that happened, it was just so bizarre.
Thing is, it doesn't work. Nobody cares about them up here.
No, I mean, like, people have stopped. People have started calling them the LA Angels, which I guess is what they wanted, but. So I don't know what the breakdown is out there, but it's such a ridiculous name for a team.
Well, yeah, I mean, from a marketability standpoint, I mean, like, and I'm in South LA County now, and I just don't see anything with Angels. Like, the billboards don't have, like, the furthest north you're going to see anything Angels wise is Long Beach, which is like the city right on the border. Like, it's the last place you go before you get to Orange County. And that's just a California geography lesson for everybody. And that's the furthest north you're going to see anything Angels related. But the Angels now talking about, you know, maybe going to Northridge, doing all these other things. Like, they to me, I just hate when teams, like, they want to have the cake and eat it too. They want to benefit from, you know, the money that's in Anaheim and the, you know, youth support and the families that are there. But then they also want to call themselves LA, and now they're considering moving themselves to LA. I also understand that this is the pot calling the kettle black, since my pro football team has housed itself in New Jersey for decades. But I don't really care about that, because someone find me a place in New York State that is reasonable driving distance to the city where you'd be able to house the Giants.
Yeah, that thing is always, maybe, you know, yelling at the Angels for that, for what they did, but the Angels didn't move. They just decided they don't actually exist. It's like in Connecticut, there's the whole thing, if you're up in Bridgeport, which is, if not the biggest city in Connecticut, it's, you know, one of the two or three, and there's a lot of Bridgeport that's actually really nice compared to what the, you know, general criticisms of it are. It's not the nicest city at all. And there are parts that are, like, really, like, nice suburban areas, but they just pretend like they're in the surrounding towns of Trumbull and Fairfield, and their kids that live there will go to the schools in Trumbull and Fairfield, but they're actually living in Bridgeport, and people just won't admit that they do. That's kind of how I feel about the Angels. The Giants and Jets, I mean, where are you going to put a stadium? I mean, they had the whole West Side Stadium thing, but that fell through. It's just... It is what it is. I mean, North Jersey is part of the New York metropolitan area. People aren't, like, you know, lying about it. It's more of like an area thing versus, like, this team was named after the city that they play in, and now they don't want to be part of that identity anymore. Like, the Giants and Jets were never the New Jersey Giants and Jets. And it's just a feasibility thing. It's silly.
Very true. And that concludes our relocation and general naming rights conversation for the week. Dan, so refocusing on Syracuse football for the last 10 minutes or so. hey, we were pretty good, admittedly, until about 30 minutes. Yeah, that's kind of when we went off the rails. And considering what? Last week, I don't think we talked about Syracuse in more than 5 minutes.
It's our fault that they lost. If we had just focused on the team more and stopped getting off on these tangents, the players would have known more about the swing passes.
Yeah, I think we, unfortunately, like, it seems like whenever we talk very little about an opponent, they lose. I don't know if those things are related to one another, but yeah, we definitely, definitely for some reason, these things seem to correlate, at least in my mind. I feel like I've drawn a line. So, talking more about UVA, because I don't want to be superstitious. What do you think is going to happen this one, Dan? There's a lot of things that say Syracuse is not going to do well, but there's plenty that says they're going to do well, too. That's why I don't really agree with, you know, where that line opened up, with SU being, you know, more than a touchdown underdog.
On paper, I think Syracuse is a better team. I think statistically it's very close, but I trust our offense more. I think we have more playmakers. UVA has some nice defensive players, but the weirdest thing with UVA is they are, unless I'm just missing something, they are yet to they're yet to pick off a pass, and I think they have one fumble recovery on defense. Like, they just do not. It's not a playmaking defense this year, which is weird because they do have Quinn Blanding and a couple other nice players on that side of the ball. But not a lot of havoc going on with them. They just kind of seem to play their set packages. It's not a defense that, I mean, I'm saying this now and Donjell Doran throw three picks, but it's kind of strange how little they've done on that end. They do have some pass breakups, but that's about it. I just have this real sense of dread with Syracuse right now, based on last week and based on how ill prepared the team looked, and it being a road game again. I'm going to take Virginia in a narrow win. I hope I am very wrong, but that's just a gut feeling how this one looks, and I'm probably being too quick to judge the team based on one bad performance, but I do think it's easier to view the Central Michigan and Wake Forest games through a different lens now that the South Florida game happened the way it did versus how the team looked against LSU. So hopefully I'm very wrong, and hopefully Syracuse is able to knock off Virginia, and last week looks more like an anomaly, but for whatever reason, I just don't feel good about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of where I'm at, as much as I don't want to be. Like, there's a lot of problems here that I don't think are just going to, like, go away right off the bat. I think we're kind of looking at, you know, a defense that is troublingly, like, not at all good. And it's, again, really weird that... I think somebody in the comments actually pointed out something that I found kind of jarring and interesting about, you know, just our general fandom and all that, that, you know, we call Syracuse's defense great, all these things. Like, they've only finished, like, top 50 in the country once, according to, I think, S&P metrics in the past, like, decade. And considering that's, like, what we kind of, as a group, hang our hat on, yeah, and it seems like other fan bases do, too, when it comes to us. It's funny, because I feel like UVA fans, when I was talking to them, the first thing they were talking about was the SU defense. I think it's really funny to me that that's what we're hanging our hat on, that's what Schaefer's hanging his hat on, that's what we're, like, you know, praising Bulla for, considering that we haven't really been doing that well, and to me, anyway, that the secondary is just getting worse and worse every single season.
Yeah, the secondary has just been an issue pretty consistently, except for a couple moments. But I think generally this defense has done well, and maybe it is kind of a youth thing this year, but if you're going to have, like, a super young defense make a ton of mistakes, it just doesn't seem like it's breakdowns in the play on the field. It just seems like the scheme has some incredibly not well thought out issues. Like, it just seems like we're so quick to give up, like, smaller plays in order to not get beat deep, that we're just allowing teams to pick up chunk yardage, and then when something happens like the USF flea flicker, I guess it was more of a double, what was it, I can't remember exactly what the trick play was, but it was ridiculous.
I think it was a flea flicker.
Was it a flea flicker? It was like a reverse flea flicker or something crazy. Like, when someone actually takes off the top off the defense on us, like, it just totally breaks the entire game open because the defense is so dedicated to not getting beat way deep that it's still not good enough to guarantee that, so it's not working the way it's designed. So I think youth is an easy thing to pin its uses to, and it'd be valid if it was guys just, you know, missing assignments and whatnot, but it's a lot of it's just the scheme doesn't seem to be working as intended most of the time, or a lot of the time, and USF showed that, especially when, you know, they come in with one different look that's not like anything too crazy. It's not even as way out there as like what Georgia Tech runs. It's just a lot of misdirection and stuff, which every team uses, just not to the effect that USF did, but like just one different, you know, offensive style, and the whole game was over. And you even heard it after the game where Fedova's Buller Schaefer pretty much said like, oh, they, you know, played way harder today than they had on tape. Well, should you be accounting for the team playing as hard as like humanly possible every game, and then if they don't, they don't? Like, it just, it's there wasn't much to be encouraged by before or after, or during or after the game, and it's USF. And going to UVA, I mean, I don't think they're very good, but they at least keep things close. And a team that can keep things close against Notre Dame or even Pitt is going to be one that can beat Syracuse. So hopefully Syracuse, you know, as I've said, like, hopefully it was just one really bad outing and the team got super refocused afterwards. But I've seen this story before. So if when they prove me wrong, I'll be happy to take my comeuppance, which comes in the form of my alma mater winning. So it's not that bad.
Yeah, at the end of the day, if you make a bold statement about your team losing and they win, I don't really see where the punishment part happens other than you being wrong, which, to be honest, people who talk about sports, either part-time or full-time, by and large, they're wrong just as much, if not more so, than they're right, because you're not really graded on any of that at the end of the day unless you happen to be like your outlet's gambling expert.
I can tell you for a fact that I am not that.
I don't think we have one. Which, although that would be a good thing for a lot of people that we've seen comment on things that are not thrilled about the rampant use of Vegas betting lines and things like that. I know those are the same people that got mad at Joey Bats yesterday. And to be honest, those people can shove it because of the gambling stuff, but because anyone who wants to flip their bat every goddamn time they hit anything can do it. And as Sean pointed out on Twitter, I hope Eric Dungy flips something every single time that he scores a touchdown. I don't care. Like, show some character, shows a little bit of, you know, moxie. I'm a fan of it.
Yeah, it's crazy that people play sports and have fun doing them. It's kind of a weird thing that, you know, seems to, you know, when you think about it, it's actually at the heart of why people play sports. So when they actually show that they're having fun, I think that's fine. I think people should be able to flip whatever they want.
I would concur.
Don't flip people off on Saturday. That'd be pretty bad.
Really? Because I do that all the time.
If Dungy goes full stone cold after every touchdown, I think we might get in trouble.
All right. So I'll close out with my prediction. I see this game being very close. I think that you know, Dungy and Lester have heard their own criticisms, both from each other and from fans. Things have been a little too conservative starting games on offense, and I feel like it you know, it shot us in the foot, especially in the last two games when we lost. I see Syracuse winning this one, though it won't be totally pretty. I think the defense rebounds a little bit, forces a couple turnovers. I think Dungy's able to limit mistakes. Hopefully, you know, get the ball to our running backs a little bit more, en route to a 27-23 win, which would be a welcome sight for all SU fans, not so much for UVA fans, but also potentially give them the chance to just fire London now, because based on, you know, how things have been working lately in college coaching, this is now firing season.
Yeah, I mean, it's all nice that Virginia can pretty much claim to be the most patient college football program in the country, but I think they probably need to fire Mike London. It's just not working.
Agreed.
Maybe they can re-divert him to, I mean, instead of having to buy him out, maybe they can put him on the campus police staff.
Maybe they'll end up sending him to Syracuse. Please no.
We could probably use a semester campus police, so after, and hopefully everyone who's listening is safe and stayed safe last night during all that nonsense.
Very much concur. And on that note, that was Dan. I'm John. Thank you, as always, for listening to Troy Noon's An Absolute Podcast. And Dan, thank you for joining.
You are very welcome. Good luck to our Orange this weekend. Hopefully my prediction looks ridiculous.
And hopefully mine looks 100% right. Go Orange.
Let's go Mets.